Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't.
Our guest this week grew up in Columbus, Nebraska, earned a BA in biochemistry from Johns Hopkins University, an MBA from the University of Chicago, and a diploma in law from Oxford. From 91 to 94, he was a senior associate at Booz Allen Hamilton. And from 94 to 2001, he was a founding partner of Diamond Management and Technology Consultants. Since 2012, he's been the founding partner of Martis Capital, which specializes in buyout and growth equity investments in middle market healthcare companies. His name, Barry Uphoff. And I'm Jack Brasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Brasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to a shining example of the American dream, Barry Uphoff. Barry, welcome. An honor to have you.
Jack, thank you for having me.
All right, let's start with growing up in Columbus, Nebraska. You had a silver spoon in your mouth. Your mom was 16. Your dad was 17. You were raised by grandparents. Tell us about the early journey.
Yeah, well, I don't remember those first couple of years extremely well, Jack. But the early years and growing up in Columbus, Nebraska was a wonderful place. City of about 15,000 people, and it was very it was a place where you knew your cousins, your grandparents, all the relatives, and it felt like a big world and a small world at the same time. You had family close by, and In the state of Nebraska, I think at that time it was probably the seventh largest city, plus or minus. So I felt like I was from a big city, but learned later in life that that wasn't so big after all, I guess.
Raised by grandparents, what's the biggest thing they taught you, Barry?
Gosh, biggest thing they taught me was just to work hard. You know, this was my grandfather, I consider to be my father. Yeah, I think he always had at least three or four jobs at any one time, whether it was planting tomatoes, selling steel chains, planting various things in the garden, painting bridges. You know, he was always working hard, saving, and never taking on any debt. So it was a special generation.
What's the first jobs you had as a young entrepreneur?
I think the first job I had as a young entrepreneur was selling some of those tomatoes. You know, my father, he had this tomato farm. We took him to the horse racing track, and he would sell them there. And if there were some left over, I would set up a little stand and sell them along a blacktop road there near Highway 30.
All right. Your mom was 16. Your dad was 17. Raised by grandparents, this little town, you had nothing. Today, Martis Capital has $2 billion with a B in equity capital. It's so rare, a one in a billion. Why you? Do you ever ask God, why me?
Yeah, you know, it's you just kind of put one on that working hard point. You set a path, you start working, and sometimes that path takes you in directions that you don't necessarily intend. I was very focused on becoming a physician early on in life. My grandfather passed away when I was nine. So the notion of being a physician and curing others was very aspirational and was a goal. And it's what led me to Johns Hopkins. And then you get going on that path and you find other areas. You come across some mentors, right, that teach you things, and you start, all of a sudden you find you're heading in a direction of something you like, and you run after that hard, and all, you realize, gosh, we got a couple billion dollars to invest here. We need to do a great job for those folks.
All right, let's go back 25 years. Speaking of mentors, every Nebraskan had a mentor by the name of Tom Osborne. Tell us about Tom Osborne.
Yeah, gosh, Tom Osborne was that, I don't know a kid in Nebraska that probably didn't dream of playing football for Dr. Tom. You know, he was always had an incredible team. You know, Nebraskans, the football program was really important to every Nebraskan. It was something we had a lot of pride in. And, you know, I was born in 1967. He became coach, gosh, I guess it was the early 70s after Bob Devaney. So grew up with him as the head of the team. And, you know, back in those days, if we weren't paying for a national championship, it was probably a disappointing season in some respects. But he was an incredible coach. I think he was the first coach to hit 250 wins in 25 years, and just had a tremendously dominant team in the 90s.
And then he became a U.S. House of Representative from Nebraska's 3rd District in those mid-90s, the Cornhuskers, 95, 96, 97. Some say those were the greatest college teams ever.
Oh, they were, Jack. No, there were some great teams. You know, they were physical. They were well-prepared. They were dominant, both sides of the ball. Alabama certainly has had some great teams in recent years, but I would take my 95-96 Huskers up against any team.
All right. Then you go to Johns Hopkins University, majoring in biochemistry. You wanted to become a doctor. What happened?
Yeah, no, your point on mentors, was well on that path, was lucky enough to get accepted to their medical school. And you know, I took a little diversion, Jack, and had an opportunity to go to Oxford on a scholarship, and had never been outside the United States at that point, and decided to do that. So went to England and pursued law for a couple of years, and got to know a few people in and around healthcare, and kind of opened my eye to the aspect of pursuing the business side of medicine, and not necessarily the clinical side.
Johns Hopkins has a fabulous reputation. You know, for healthcare, probably their most famous is Dr. Ben Carson. You would come in second. Talk to us, what makes this Johns Hopkins so special?
Yeah, well, it's an incredible university. A tremendous amount of, I would say, research is what really makes it unique. Gosh, by the time I was a junior, Jack, I had already done research with two different Nobel laureates there at the school. So you could, it's not a place you want to go and just sort of be an undeclared major and say, I'll figure it out. There's some pretty focused individuals there. And if you know what you want to do and what you're focused on, it's a wonderful place. And you can have tremendous relationships with some of the best and brightest professors and researchers, I think, on the planet.
We're talking to Barry Uphoff. If you want to learn more, www.martiscapital.com. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Barry Uphoff. Barry, you go to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. I don't think there's too many kids from Columbus, Nebraska, that became a Rhodes Scholar. One, what is a Rhodes Scholar, and how do you become a Rhodes Scholar?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I was approached in my junior year, right before my junior year, actually, about applying for the scholarship, and you know, did some research, and it's a 2-year scholarship to go to Oxford University and pretty much study whatever you like. Now, there has to be some logic to what you want to study as part of your application process, and if you're lucky enough to get the scholarship, it you know it covers your tuition, provides room and board, and you know, it's just a great opportunity to live in a foreign country and study in a different approach, right? They have more Socratic approach to teaching at Oxford compared with the large lecture hall format in the United States.
Oxford has to be one of the 5 or 10 most premier universities in the world. Tell us about Oxford.
Well, it's that, Jack. It's very, gosh, the diversity of student base was tremendous you know, in my second year, I recall living in a, I lived in a flat. We had a person in that flat, this house with different rooms. There was a person from China, a person from South Africa, Germany, Canada, and Spain, and the Barbados was the lineup. It was an incredible mix of people. You know, the teaching format, the Socratic-based format of given a basically a question that you research over a course of a week, and then you get together in a small group and read an essay that you've prepared to answer that question is a very unique way to learn, and I think a very good one for law. And then I would say, you know, it's a place that's you know, it's a pretty good gateway to a lot of Europe, and afforded an opportunity to travel a lot throughout Europe and England as well.
You also got an MBA from the University of Chicago, South Side of Chicago, and then from 91 to 94, you were a senior associate at Booz Allen Hamilton. Talk about that chapter, please.
Yeah, Booz Allen's a, I did those two things simultaneously. I actually went to school full time while I was working at Booz Allen. They were tremendous in allowing me to do that. You know, Booz Allen is a consulting firm where I think there's a lot of operational detail. Did a lot of time and motion studies, and you know, was working predominantly in hospitals and healthcare delivery systems, trying to make things better, faster, cheaper. It was the beginning of managed care, and we did a lot of work to see what would the ramifications to hospitals be with increased managed care penetration in the U.S.
I spent 26 years with a firm, Decision Consultants, the IT services business. And in 94, this thing comes out of nowhere, all right, like a rocket, called Diamond Management and Technology Consultants. Yeah. You were a founding partner. How'd you guys ever do it?
Yeah, there were a few of us from Booz Allen, a few from Anderson Consulting, now Accenture, a couple from McKinsey, and about 12 of us. We came together, and look, we had a vision that, and mind you, this was the early 90s, and we had a vision that technology was going to change business and business strategy, and that the only way to really be a good management consultant was to have those two disciplines, technology and business strategy, intertwined. And so often the cultures and consulting firms at that time were pretty strong. You were either a technology consultant, like maybe Anderson, or you were a strategy consultant from McKinsey, as examples. And the view was, let's create a firm with people from both disciplines where everybody buys into that culture and that differentiation. So we each wrote checks to help start the firm, and we raised some money from this a little VC outside of Philadelphia called Safeguard Scientifics as well.
And you were with them for 6.5 years. You led their healthcare division, and God gave you something called Y2K that helped you out quite a bit too.
He sure did. I remember Y2K quite well. Yeah, I led their healthcare practice and strategy practices, and we sold to work and did projects with a lot of great, you know, pharma and healthcare delivery and insurance, healthcare insurance companies along the way. And you're right, a lot of folks were very concerned about Y2K. Folks were concerned that, you know, things were going to stop, planes were going to fly out of the air, but fortunately none of that happened.
And some of these countries that spend almost no money on this Y2K, somehow the stuff works.
It worked.
It continued to work. So
It sure did. But that was a great experience, Jack. That was one of, you know, really opened my eyes to seeing, you know, as a consultant, you're working on a rate times hours basis. And as an owner in this firm, you know, got to see really the power of ownership and how motivating that can be and rewarding and how it can create a common culture. And, you know, we grew the business, like you mentioned, tremendously. And we did go public in 1997. Goldman Sachs took us public, and that was you know, quite an experience to be able to do that.
All right, from 2001 to 2003, 2.5 years you were with Trivest Partners. You also led their healthcare investing. Talk about that chapter, please.
Yeah, that was a kind of a logical chapter. You know, in the consulting firm, we would do a lot of due diligence projects for private equity firms, and Trivest happened to be one of those firms. I got to know one of the partners at Trivest, worked together on a few things, and was lucky enough to get an offer to join their firm and do a healthcare fund. So we raised a one-time healthcare fund at Trivest in the early 2000s, and that was my first foray into institutional, into private equity investing.
All right, let's go to January 2012. You convinced Linda, your wife, to let you start a private equity company, founding partner, Martis Capital. How does one go about starting his or her first private equity firm?
Well, I had, this kind of goes back to Nebraska a little bit, Jack. My one of my dear friends from age 12, junior high school, Stephen George, at that time was the chief investment officer for Jeff Skull's family office, Capricorn. Jeff was a co-founder of eBay. And, Jeff's a wonderful, wonderful human being. He was the first person under 40 to create a $1 billion foundation, as I recall, and just does a lot of great things in the world. And well, when I was at Trivest, raising that healthcare fund, Capricorn ended up being, and Jeff's family office, the largest investor in that fund. So I, got to know, Capricorn and Jeff as an investor, and they would reach out every now and then and ask for some thoughts on investments that they were seeing as well. And we delivered really good returns for Capricorn. It was a tremendous fund, and that just kind of led down the path to Martis and being effectively seeded by Capricorn. Our first fund was $250 million, and of that 250, about half of it was Capricorn. So they really helped put me in business, if you will. Despite, I have to share one little kind of fun story. In the early to mid 2000s, when I was at Trivest, at one point, Jeff and Capricorn reached out and they said, "What do you think about electric cars?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm from Nebraska. I kind of like the sound of a V8. So I'm not so sure about that idea, but look, Jeff, Elon was your roommate at Stanford, so you probably ought to give him a few dollars." So Jeff and Elon were roommates at Stanford, and Jeff was kind of feeling out my view a little bit there on electric cars. So I'm glad he didn't take too much negativity out of my comment there.
We're talking to Barry Uphoff. Luckily, he didn't spend too much, if any money, investing on ethanol and all the corn from Nebraska. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with Barry Uphoff, who started Martis Capital 2012. Today, it's got $2 billion with a B in equity capital. If you want to learn more, www.martiscapital.com. Barry, what does Martis invest in?
Hey Jack, we focus, look, healthcare is a big industry. So within healthcare, there's really three subsegments where we focus: healthcare services, healthcare technology, which is really software, and third, some areas that are more product oriented, healthcare products. So those are the three areas. What we don't do pharma, biotech, life sciences. Those are fine areas to invest, but require a little bit different skill and not where we focus as a team.
All right. I quote you now, we help existing companies grow, and you love to find companies where the founder is still very involved. Why is that so important to you?
Yeah. Yeah, Jack, look, we love to back founder-led companies. We like to be the first institutional capital into a company. We really like to find situations where a founder has started a business, it's been very successful, but they find themselves at a bit of a crossroads. They realize they become very successful, and they need either some institutional, they need some help in growing to the next level, or maybe they need to sell their business. You know, our perspective is partner with us, let us invest with you, and we'll grow this business more and more together. You know, that that's what excites us. It creates great alignment. You know, if a founder of a business and an owner is willing to remain significantly invested in a company, that's a great indication that they have a lot of confidence that that business is going to do well. And that's why we really like those founder-led situations.
There is a man in Michigan, an iconic middle market lender named Mark Gregory, between Comerica and now Huntington. He's been in this market. He's owned this marketplace for almost 50 years. And he's got some very strong beliefs. And one is that he says, I bet on the jockey more than the horse. What's he telling us?
Yeah, what he's really saying, and that makes a tremendous amount of sense, is, you know, you're betting on the leader, right? You're betting on the leader of the organization, the jockey, not the horse, not necessarily the company. You know, I think we like to bet on both. We like there to be a really good horse, but we want a really good jockey as well, because industries change, opportunities present themselves, and if you have a great leader, a great jockey, you know, they're going to be successful in leading that horse, if you will, you know, through those challenges or opportunities.
All right, I quote you again. We spend a great amount of time dating. That's the word you use, dating the founder or founders. How do you figure out as you date them whether this is another Linda, someone you want to marry with?
You spend a lot of time with them. You know, you have a lot of conversations with them. Sometimes this process of getting to know a founder, it can take years. And we had a situation in Michigan, Jack, one of our investments in our first fund, where I first met the founder in about 2002, 2003. And there was not really a transaction to be done at the time. But we kept in touch. We compared notes. You know, he would occasionally come to me for business advice. And in doing so, you know, I'm continuing to learn about his business, which was a company called Visiting Physicians of America, later became U.S. Medical Management and was sold to Centene in 2014. Well, we kept in touch. Like I said, we first met in 2002, 2003. We had a rather long dating period of getting to know one another over casual conversation and coffees and such. And then when there was a nice opportunity to make an investment in 2009, 2010 timeframe, we did so. You know, he had an opportunity for growth. He needed capital. There was a financial crisis going on at the time, or just wrapping up, as you might recall. And you know, the stars aligned. And at that point, it was rather quick to close that transaction, because we had all that history, if you will, that history of getting to know one another and understand the business, and him better understanding me as an investor.
All right. You mentioned great leaders. What makes a great, brilliant leader?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you look at some of the great, great leaders, I think a lot of the common themes you'll see is someone who will, certainly has a vision, right? But breaks it down and sets tangible goals to get there. They certainly work hard and are dedicated. And then I would also say they have a lot of people who will follow them, good people who will follow them. They're able to attract and retain people who will follow them to execute upon what they're doing. And then they're just pretty relentless in getting there. You know, going back to previously, I was lucky enough being out here on the West Coast, and some of the ties that I mentioned between Capricorn and Elon Musk, they're able to observe Elon and his passion for building Tesla. And it was remarkable. You know, his attention to detail, the pride that he took, the passion, ability to overcome adversity. You know, just work through those things. And that's common across our companies that we invest in as well, is finding those great leaders with those characteristics.
As I've watched entrepreneurs these past 50 years, Some of them are great at scaling. Others, they never scale. And one of the reasons is they can never let go. They don't delegate. They don't hire. Maybe they hire great people, but they don't let them become stars. And the best ones leave. Talk to us about being a great delegator.
Yeah. Being a great delegator is, as you said, it's getting those great people around that leader, and then that leader, really enabling them to take ownership of aspects of a business. And I think one of the key things there, Jack, is just how many people, right? How many close leaders are there to delegate to? So that leader, we look a lot at span of control and how many people they're trying to lead. If they're trying to lead 20 to 30 people, if they're trying to delegate to 20 to 30 people, that's too many. Then that leader can't be effective. On the flip side, if they're trying to delegate to one or two people, it's probably too few and you're not getting everything done that you need to. I think we've found that the ideal number, I think this is important, is about 5 to 7 people. 5 to 7 people that leader holds very close, very accountable, and lets them do their thing. I'll give you one example of a company in the Midwest that we've invested in and observed that has done a tremendous job with this is Epic Systems out of Verona, Wisconsin, a dominant electronic medical record company led by Judy Faulkner. That is a big business. Roughly 2/3 or more of the U.S. has their medical record reside in Epic. It's a big company, probably over 10,000 employees, based upon what I've read. If you look at that business, I think Judy's done a very good job of surrounding herself with not a tremendous number of people. It's a handful of people, and in doing so, they're pretty darn nimble, from our observation, and being an investor with them in making decisions quickly and continuing to be just the dominant EMR company out there.
Talking to Barry Uphoff. When we come back, we're going to ask him what advice would he give to young fledgling entrepreneurs. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Barry Uphoff, a shining example of the American dream. Barry, I'm a fledgling entrepreneur. What do I do?
Well, let's assume, Jack, you've got a great idea. Let's just start there. Or a nice company. I would say, as you look to execute, just be on time for all you do. I know that sounds like a really simple point, but it can be pretty off-turning if you're not on time for different things, and you might miss an opportunity. I think you should set goals, stretch goals, but realistic. You don't want to set such audacious goals that you're just failing every time in those. You want to have it be goals that are achievable. I assume as an entrepreneur, you're probably going to work hard. You may end up needing to work even harder at what you do. You probably ought to find yourself a few mentors that have been there and done that in your industry, just some aspect, and ask them a lot of questions, right? Just find those mentors and ask them a lot of questions along the way. Those are some things that I would say as an entrepreneur you ought to be thinking about and doing.
The only constant today is change. And I've always said that in business today, you must keep learning while you're earning. Talk to us about being a constant student.
Yeah, boy. That's being a constant student, always being curious, always asking questions. It's certainly, I always try to impress upon my sons. I think have three sons and you know, back in the day when I was going to school to apply to medical school, I was probably focused a little bit too much on grades than learning, although they kind of come hand in hand. That aspect of just asking questions and learning is critical. It's something that we observe in our best leaders as well, Jack. Going back to that epic example, they're the dominant company. But if you were to ask firms out there that do research in the EMR space, hey, who's most curious about their competitive position and potential threats? We know one in particular, and they would say Epic. Epic asks us the most questions every year on how are we doing, what can we do better, and that curiosity is critical, especially in industries like healthcare and technology, Jack, where there's pretty rapid change. There's a tremendous amount of innovation in both of those industries, and they're industries where a lot of what you're producing are ideas and executing upon ideas. You just have to constantly be ahead. And the only way you're going to do that is by being curious.
All right. Following up on that, let's talk about a couple of current trends. One, aging in place, and two, telehealth, please.
Yeah. Aging in place and telehealth. Well, certainly, you know, it's a country where aging as a society, just overall, and living longer. That's something, aging in place. If you think about someone when you are sick, you know, the last place you probably want to be or should be is a hospital. You know, it's a place you can get infections. It's not a particularly desirable place to be from a patient standpoint. It's a thesis that we've really believed in going back to our first fund, investing in the physician house call business, where doctors would come into the home and see you, right, as an elderly patient and take a look around. It's so important to understand for the aging population, what are you eating? You know, you might say, well, I'm eating well, but take a look in the refrigerator. And is there really food in there? Are you sleeping okay? Are there things to slip or trip on? You know, so just by doing aging in place in the home and staying on top of one's healthcare, it's a much better approach than becoming sick quickly, winding up in a hospital where it's very expensive, and you can even get sicker, you know, from just being there.
All right, telehealth.
Yeah. Yeah, telehealth really just takes that whole trend to the next level, Jack. Going back to that physician house call business, where the physician in that particular company that we were invested in, they would visit the home every 2 weeks to check in on the patient and see how they were doing. Well, now imagine if you have telehealth, like this iPhone I'm using here, or other, to be able to stay in touch with the patient even more frequently than every other week, right? So it just it enables a more frequent conversation. It enables greater convenience. You know, if you think about that time the physician would spend going to the patient's home, that could take 30 minutes or more just to get there. So you save that time and efficiency, and really it's become, you know, just a standard of care and how we do things. You know, I know there was COVID certainly helped accelerate that trend around telehealth. It was well on its way, but it's one that only, like I said, it only got accelerated and in many respects has become a standard of care in healthcare. And something that that we push to enable and do a lot of in our healthcare companies.
We're talking to Barry Uphoff. You want to learn more? www.martiscapital.com. Barry, paint for us a picture of healthcare in 2025?
In 2025. So we're going out 3 years. I think you probably continue to see rapid development of therapeutics, right? I mean, we saw how quickly companies like Moderna, Pfizer, and others developed vaccines for COVID using messenger RNA and DNA-based discovery techniques. I think you continue to see that not only in for vaccines, but in other therapeutic areas as well that come to market that might be helpful in areas of cancer and other. I think you continue to see advancement in diagnostics. You know, one of the things we see a lot of today is an ability to just do whole blood DNA testing, you know, extract blood, run that through a diagnostic machine, and see what's effect floating around in your bloodstream. You know, what fragments of DNA can we see that might be able to point better to illnesses that are in the body that might not be easier to find out. I mentioned before, my grandfather, he passed away from pancreatic cancer. That's a very tough one to detect. Today, however, through whole blood analysis, you know, it's something you stand a much better chance of picking up early on. And then last, I would say just continued proliferation of telehealth and consumerism in healthcare. You know, the way healthcare is consumed or purchased today is, you know, is very different from 5, 10, 20 years ago. You know, we've come to expect to be able to get quality healthcare like we're communicating today. And maybe that's behavioral healthcare, for instance, being able to see a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a therapist like we are here today. I think we're only going to see an acceleration in those trends.
Oh, yeah, Paul, you're a extremely successful man. But more importantly, you're a very humble, caring, classy, centered man. Keep up the great, great work.
Thanks, Jack. Have a great day.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.